pictures as a kid. We used to look at some of the concentration camps. They'd already been empty, but he got in there and got photographs. Yeah. Wow.
After the potluck is over, some of us gather in the parking lot to talk about the event and say our goodbyes. Kat and Rich talk about a silent auction and the money donated at the potluck event.
Very well done, Mr. Sheffield.
Well, okay, it worked out.
Oh yes, my gosh.
Almost a mega event. No. Is that what you were saying?
We should have invited some more people in. It would have been a mega event.
Brad and I are going to do a travel bug race for the event in May, and I'm going to help Arlene out with some auction items. I love doing silent auction and all that stuff. Yeah.
I like it too when I don't have to do it.
Good. Well, it's a money maker. If you get some good things,
it is.
You can get some. I mean, people have fun with it too. I think we got rid of a lot of stuff on those tables.
We got about $150 in bills in there. Probably 15 memberships. Sealed envelopes that probably have the Thames in them.
Finally, I sit down with Rich to discuss the history behind the annual Slaga potluck. I get his take on how this event worked out.
Let's have a seat over here. End of the day, and we're still hanging around the parking lot talking like we usually do after a geocaching event. I'm here with RTS. You were the instigator of the potlucks, weren't you? Or would you say you were also the host this time?
Yeah, I guess they originated with Mike Bollinger in Jeff City. He had the first two potlucks back in January. I can't remember, 3 years or 4 years ago, I was trying to remember. He just decided it got too expensive for him because he put the whole thing on himself. Everybody seemed to enjoy it, so then I guess the last 3 years, we decided to have him here. So this is just a continuation of what Mike Bollinger started.
Well, what's the philosophy behind it? Just another excuse for geocachers to get together?
I think it is. Whenever I have an event like this, any kind of an event, I try to make it disorganized, and that's the way I like to keep it. So there's basically no event caches hidden, no caching plans, just kind of a get-together, talk, greet, and then do whatever you want. This time we just did a few things. We had everything's a $3 table. All the money from there went to Slaga. We played geocache bingo, which Muriel actually started. That was her idea at the fall picnic, which seemed to be a big success, and I think everybody enjoyed it here, too.
How does that work?
We got three different bingo cards. What you have to do is got 25 squares on it. Each square has some kind of a question related to caching, like somebody that owns a Magellan found 500 caches, the first event they've been to. And each of the three cards are different, and then they would have to go around and talk to everybody and get their signatures on the cards.
So the $3 table, what was that?
That was just anything that anybody had they wanted to get rid of, that we were going to pitch or whatever. We just brought it, and anybody that wanted to buy it, just $3 donation, regardless of what it was, to Slaga.
Any donations or membership dues being paid?
Yeah, we had a jar for membership dues. Actually, I was really surprised. We had about $150, $180 of cash laying in that jar, which were donations and money from the $3 table. Mm-hmm. And then there was probably 10 or 15 envelopes that were for people paying for their dues, $10 or more.
There was also a travel bug geocoin table?
It was a little different this year, yeah. A couple of events I've been at, and it always seems to happen at any event. If people bring travel bugs, they log them in the event, people discover them. And then when the event's over, all the bugs may be gone or there may be some left, and somebody picks them up and takes it. They never get logged out of the event. Whoever runs the event gets emails from the bug owners. I think what worked good this time is L. Frank and his wife, Lori, and they made a board, and all the travel bugs that were brought were logged in onto a sheet as far as who brought it, and they were hung up on a board where the mission was of the bug to go or whatever was supposed to be done. And then if anybody physically took it somewhere else, then they would log it out on that sheet. So we know at that point who actually has it when it was gone.
So everything's accountable.
And if there's any left, we know who brought it and we can return it to that person. Mm. Coin table I didn't get involved with, but there's lots of coin books being displayed over there. So I stay away from those things. They looked heavy, I know.
So in general, things went pretty well. How was the weather and the turnout?
Well, the weather was good. Normally we've had cold, cold weather, but today it was supposed to be in the mid-40s and sunny, and I think it was. A lot of people were caching before the event, during and after. Our 130 were signed up. Looked like we had at least 100 people sign the sign-in sheet, but then some of those included a family that may have been two or three people with one entry. I think we exceeded our 130 people because we still had about 8 or 10 walk-ins.
How far away did some of the people come?
There was one fellow from Kansas City, and the other one, which I was going to give him a long-distance award, came from the eastern end of North Carolina. But they were here, and they signed up, but I never saw them, and then we got ready to give out the awards.
Anything to say about the food?
All very good. I don't think there was any complaints with anybody. In fact, I got the last of the double leg. Okay. That went pretty quick, but I think those always do.
I was the last one in line. Actually, right in front of me was Walt, and he was there for his second. So he let me go ahead of him to get my first, so he'd get his second.
This time we had a very good selection of meat in the main dishes. Normally that seems to be the weak point, is everybody brings dessert or a salad or something. But this time we had more than enough meat and ham and roast beef and chili and escacholi and sandwiches and everything else.
So it seems like we're getting better and better at this thing.
Yeah, people are contributing more to get a little more fare for the rest of the group.
What about the facilities?
I think it's the best we've had. The building is just huge. We could have hit bowling alleys in here, shooting ranges and everything. But
could have hit some caches in there.
We could have.
Taking them a while to find them.
Yeah. We had a fireplace, and the park provided the firewood, and Dave, CDS 231, got the fire going. Everybody got here a little bit early. The setup went real good compared to the learning center out there. I think we've outgrown that place. Hopefully we can get this again next year for our next huge event.
Well, thanks again, Rich, for making these things happen.
Okay, no problem.
This concludes the Slaga Podcast. For more information about the Slaga Group and geocaching in the St. Louis, Missouri area, go to www.geostl.com. Here's wishing you a strong signal and a trusty bearing.
But it had an unfortunate demise. 18-4J2. Don't be stumped. Oh, gosh. I don't know what that could mean.
Those are the dead giveaways.
I don't know what that could mean. Maybe they mean it's in a tree way up.
There they are.
I'm Walt.
Right, Team DLADL.
Lamsey. L-A-M-C-E, and that's Puglet.
Are you A&W?
Yeah, the W part.
There's an easy way in there, there's a hard way. There's one way where you almost have to crawl on your knees, and an easier way.
Paul, you take the hard way, and I'll go the easy way.
Okay. But it's obvious where it is when you get there.
We didn't take the easy way, did we?
No, I came out the easy way.
This can't be the difficult way in. What did they say? Stump.
Right there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I can see it.
There it is. It's small, I guess. Huh? Yeah. They must have come in from the back side. Oh, yeah. That would not be pleasant.
Oh, look at this little tiny thing.
Oh, got a
little band there.
Looks like a bullet of some kind.
Those three guys I met this morning in the first cache I did. It was a Do You Play Disc Golf?
Oh, yeah.
It's right in the, as you come in.
Yeah. Well, that was pretty painless.
Sometimes you like them easy, but sometimes you don't like them too easy.
For us, depends upon the weather. If it's cold out, we really don't want to be tromping around too much. If it's rather nice out and you have to wander around a little bit, that's okay.
And that's one thing that Elaine likes to do if we go walking in the woods for a couple of miles. She's enjoying the walk. Yeah. And she's looking at the surroundings and she's noticing the flowers. Yeah. While I'm doing this, 10th of a mile.
Yeah.
0.4.
You've got
0.3.
Right. And all of a sudden you turn around and they're back there about 50 yards smelling a flower or doing something like that.
I have a short interview with Paula Collins from Northern Illinois, who caches with her husband as Cinema Boxers. She is an artist and geocoin designer. You can find a link to her website in my show notes.
We're sitting outside in the slightly windy, slightly cold atmosphere outside of the Slaga Potluck. We're going to talk a little bit about caching and geocoins.
My name is Paula Collins. We cache under the name Cinema Boxers. I design geocoins. We're also very active cachers. We're now trying to hit our 600th while we're out this weekend, all the way from Northern Illinois. We came down to visit with Arthur and Trillian, who are friends, and 57 Chevy, who I got to meet for the first time. Okay. We've been friends for a really long time, though.
Is that because you're all coin collectors?
Yeah, it's a great friendly community, and you really get to be close friends with a lot of people.
Have you been to St. Louis before?
My first time.
Really?
I grew up right on the Illinois-Wisconsin border, still live right around that area. It's a high cache concentration area. We have a lot of really active local groups.
What first got you into geocaching?
We started out with letterboxing. I got into letterboxing because of the artwork involved with the stamps and just a way to get out of the house and be active. We've got a 3-year-old, too. We wanted something where we could get him out and get him used to being outside and give him something fun to do. On the letterboxing forums, they talked about geocaching. And as soon as I saw the concentration of caches in our area, I immediately wanted to get involved in that because there's a lot more caches than there are letterboxes. I've been an artist my entire life. So when I saw the geocoins, it gave me a way to be creative and also be active in the geocaching.
Do you letterbox at all, or is that now just a pass?
No, we letterbox still. We've got about 25 active boxes right now, and I did all the stamps for those. They're pretty popular boxes, so we try to keep them maintained and try to put some new ones out.
Have you found any caches since you've been here in St. Louis?
Oh, yeah, we cached the whole way down.
And what was that like?
It was a blast. There's one really good one, Funk's Grove, I think it is, on the way down Funk's Grove Rest Area. It's a cache that I totally recommend for anybody that goes down that way to hit. It's on 55, and it's just an excellent, well-thought-out cache. Not a very long one, but you do it and you love it.
Types of caches that you like?
Large caches. Not to make any enemies, but I don't like lamp skirt micros. I like caches that make me get out in the woods. I like caches that challenge me. Clever hides, clever containers. You know, I like good stories. There's nothing better than a cache that gives you a good story, takes you to a great location, and shows you something that otherwise you wouldn't have seen.
So you're here with your husband and son?
Just my husband. The little guy's at home with grandma.
Who'd want to go out in the middle of the night and find a cache?
First to find, I'll do anything. I'm the first to find night.
Okay.
We're up to, I think, over 70 first to finds now. So we got one while we were here, actually.
Really?
Got a first to find out of state. Arthur and Trillian had one published. He planted it, and it was published the day before we got here, and we were just lucky. Nobody went and got it. We got to his house, and we were the first ones to get it.
Well, I saw you spending a lot of time down by the geocoin table.
I design, sell, and mint geocoins under geocoindesign.com. That's our name. I design for a lot of other companies, for individuals, and I do a lot of my own coins. And now we mint our own and sell our own designs.
Are you by profession a graphic artist?
Mm-hmm. I'm a graphic arts and fine arts. I dabble in everything. Sculpture, I mean, you name it.
Did you develop that skill as a kid, or do you say, oh, I'm going to go to school and this is what I'm going to be and somehow make a living in it?
Since I was a kid, I've always just drawn and been creative. I mean, since I could draw, that's what I always did. My family really encouraged me. We also do web design and graphic design. I do logo work.
Are you a coin collector yourself?
I do a lot of trading. I love personal coins. They're my favorites. People that I meet, I really love those coins the best because they have more meaning to me.
How many do you have in your collection?
Goodness. Oh, probably over.
Do you have to say how many books do you have?
How many boxes? Each box is about 300 or 400, and I've got 6 boxes. A lot.
Okay.
More than I'd like to know.
Were you into geocoins when they first came out, or did you discover them later on as a way to express your art?
Later on, after we got into caching, I'd seen a few, and I still wasn't really that interested. My husband really got into the geocoins. Really wasn't that into them. And then I saw a few, Always Looking 99, dropped a coin. And it was the first coin that I saw that really was a very artistic type of coin. And I talked to him because he was a local, and he told me how to get in contact with Geocoin Store. And when I got in contact with them, they actually got me started out. Geocoin Shop in Michigan, he uses the name Camp Explorer. He actually gave me my first design jobs, took a chance, had me pick up a popular series of coins and do the second year's edition. So, I mean, that was a big chance for me.
Is it a close-knit community of people who design coins?
It's competitive. I try to get along with everybody. I don't talk badly about people. I like everybody, but it's kind of clicky. And you get people that just automatically, no matter what you do, they're not going to like you. And you could be the greatest person in the world, and they still won't like you. But I just try to be nice. I treat people well and get my job done and try to make coins that are going to sell.
Originally, coins were of a certain size. Now, that's changed over time, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Size, material,
size,
color.
Shape, you name it.
And are they more demanding? Like, well, I want something that nothing has ever done before.
Yeah, I try to do things that I think are unique, and I try to push the envelope and raise the bar a little bit when it comes to designs. I try to incorporate elements that use up more of the surface of the coin. I figure it costs the same amount of money to make, you know, a really simple coin as it does usually to make a more complex one. The difference is only in raised recessed metal. You know what you're working with and you know what your limits are, you can really push your limits on like the price of a coin or the budget for a coin.
When you draw it, are you thinking two-dimension or are you thinking three-dimension?
When I work on it, I have to think in levels, so I always have to design with levels in mind.
Once you do the design, somebody else has to transform that into the mold or the die.
I have to do the art. I designate literally every level of the coin. I designate what's raised, what's recessed, where all the colors are, you know, positive spaces, negative spaces, everything that's done I have to designate and explain to the mint. And try to get it across to them what, you know, what I'm telling them to do with the coin. So that can be kind of hard. The communication in that area can be a little bit difficult at times.
Is it quite often someone will have a stick figure and say, here, I want to make this into a coin, and you have to make interpret that?
Yeah, that happens. The best jobs are the ones where people say to me, go ahead, you're on your own. Mm-hmm. You know, these are the elements that I want in the coin.
I want a sun, I want a mountain, and I want an animal in the corner.
And when they do that, and they pretty much give me free rein to do what I want on a coin, I usually get the best designs.
Okay.
It's when I'm the most limited that it's hardest for me to work. If I'm working within a very set frame of what they want, there's no interpretation there. Those are usually the ones that I'm the least happy with. But the ones where they let me just run are the ones that usually turn out the best.
coins now come in different sizes, so you work in any size or
any
shape.
Any size.
And they're not even necessarily round anymore.
Actually, I've got one come up. It's a die-cut carousel horse. Both sides of the animal. You flip it over, and it's both sides, and it's got a hole at the top for the brass ring. Some people, you know, like the novelty coins like that, and some people like the more traditional. Even the designs, I think, have evolved since the Compass Rose. I mean, there's been some nice ones. Probably my favorite artist is Chris Mackey. He's just excellent. Fox and the Hound is his caching name. Really great artist and a really good person who did nothing but encourage me when I got into it. You get to know people that collect your coins and you get to be really good friends with.
Is there a forum that you guys spend a lot of time on just to talk about?
Yeah, the Grounds Creek Geocoin forums. So we've got a chat room, and on any given night you'll have 13, 14 people in there chatting about coins, you know, having coin tests. You know, they have contests where they give coins away and such. We had quite a collection of our group here today. Which two of them came from out of state. So that was pretty nice. We had Blue Cherry and her husband, and Woodland Clan was here today.
Not necessarily geocaching brought together, it was the coins.
The coins all had us meet. I mean, now we all cache together, too. The coins have really made us friends in a lot of other states, while normally we might have not made as many good friends in other states. I don't collect coins because they're rare. I don't collect coins because they're, you know, hard to find. I collect the coins that I love to look at, and I collect coins that I really want to have in my collection. So my taste might differ from somebody else's as far as what they collect. Collect what you love, because quite frankly, a geocoin is worthless to anybody outside the geocoin community. I could walk into a grocery store and try to buy a loaf of bread with a mountain bike, and they'd look at me like I was nuts.
The hobby's growing, waning, changing.
It's changing. You know, I get a lot of people who mint coins telling me that what would sell a year ago now, they're not selling as many coins of, because we've got a lot of great artists out there, and they've really raised the bar. A more complex design, a more detailed design is going to sell more coins, and people are now expecting more from you. Every time you do it, you've really got to put 100% effort into it. If you don't come up with something amazing, it's just not going to do well.
What are your thoughts of somebody buying a coin that you designed and then trying to make money off it on eBay?
You know, it doesn't matter to me. I mean, I'm selling the coin. I think the whole telling people what they can do with coins is kind of nonsense. If I gift someone a coin, if they need the money for family, for bills, for whatever they need the money for, by all means, sell it. Heck, ask me. I'll probably give you another one. You know, I'd help you out. I don't know. I don't get bent out of shape over it.
Appreciate you taking the time out.
Any information you need, let me know.
I record a few short geocaching experiences being related by Bronny Bear and Weymouth. Then you will hear Pandy Annie talking about the personal history behind the metal film canister, which was a cache container of a cache he just archived.
With Kevin driving around, I'm sitting there navigating, he's sitting there driving. I'll go, okay, 500 feet, 400 feet, 300 feet, 200 feet. We just passed it. What? Like, what have I been saying for the last 10 minutes? It's back there! He would get totally zoned, man. And I'd say, okay, we're coming on. Slow down, slow down, slow down, slow down, slow down, slow down. Bernie would go, I guess he didn't hear you the first 20 times.
We did more besides just the 40. We did some that were off.
A few.
We turned around one time in the creek bottom. On that one, we went way down. A magnetic in a forest. How about that? It's like, where are you going to turn
around?
There
was a magnetic in a cedar tree that was a rating of a 5 we couldn't find. We looked and looked. They said, that's pretty cruel, hiding it in a pile of leaves under the tree like that. A pile of leaves were about like that. It was like they blew in the park all the leaves under this gnarly-looking cedar. Somewhere they'd thrown a micro in there. And I was just like,
yeah.
But that's a World War II era film canister, metal one. My father, he was a photographer during the war.
It's got some historical significance.
When I first started shooting, that's what they came
in. Yeah. He went overseas near the end of the war, and he carried a BAR. And he had an unlucky incident where he tripped on a muddy road where they were marching, and he dropped it, and it sank under the mud. So the sergeant said, get it out, sit on the side of the road, clean it, and catch up with us. So he's sitting there cleaning. He was just about done, and a Jeep drove by, some general. Said, give me a ride up to your unit. So he said, fine. So they got to talking. My dad had cameras on him. Oh, you liked photography? Hmm. Next week he got transferred as a photographer for the Upfront newspaper. Whoa. And he spent the rest of his time over there traveling all over Europe taking pictures.
Just because he dropped it.
We had some pictures as a kid. We used to look at some of the concentration camps. They'd already been empty, but he got in there and got photographs.
Yeah. Wow.
After the potluck is over, some of us gather in the parking lot to talk about the event and say our goodbyes. Kat and Rich talk about a silent auction and the money donated at the potluck event.
Very well done, Mr. Sheffield.
Well, okay, it worked out.
It's almost a mega event. No. Is that what you were saying? Yeah. We should have, like, invited some more people in. It would have been a mega event.
Brad and I are going to do a travel bug race for the event in May, and I'm going to help Arlene out with some auction items. I love doing silent auction and all that stuff.
I like it too, and I don't have to do it. It works out real good.
Well, it's a money maker. If you get some good things, it is. You know, you can get some. I mean, people have fun with it too. I think we got rid of a lot of stuff on those tables.
We got about $150 in bills in there. Probably 15 memberships, sealed envelopes that probably have the Thames in them.
Finally, I sit down with Rich to discuss the history behind the annual Slaga potluck. I get his take on how this event worked out.
Let's have a seat over here. End of the day, and we're still hanging around the parking lot talking like we usually do after a geocaching event. I'm here with RTS. You were the instigator of the potlucks, weren't you? Or would you say you were also the host this time?
Yeah, I guess they originated with Mike Bollinger in Jeff City. He had the first two potlucks back in January. I can't remember, 3 years or 4 years ago, I was trying to remember. He just decided it got too expensive for him because he put the whole thing on himself. Everybody seemed to enjoy it, so then I guess the last 3 years, we decided to have him here. So this is just a continuation of what Mike Bollinger started.
Well, what's the philosophy behind it? Just another excuse for geocachers to get together?
I think it is. Whenever I have an event like this, any kind of an event, I try to make it disorganized, and that's the way I like to keep it. So there's basically no event caches hidden, no caching plans, just kind of a get-together, talk, greet, and then do whatever you want. This time we just did a few things. We had everything's a $3 table. All the money from there went to Slaga. We played geocache bingo, which Muriel actually started. That was her idea at the fall picnic, which seemed to be a big success, and I think everybody enjoyed it here, too.
How does that work?
We got, like, three different bingo cards. What you have to do is got 25 squares on it. Each square has some kind of a question related to caching, like somebody that owns a Magellan found 500 caches, the first event they've been to. Each of the three cards are different, and then they would have to go around and talk to everybody and get their signatures on the cards.
So the $3 table, what was that?
That was just anything that anybody had they wanted to get rid of, that we were going to pitch or whatever. We just brought it, and anybody that wanted to buy it, just $3 donation, regardless of what it was, to Slaga.
Any donations or membership dues being paid?
Yeah, we had a jar for membership dues. Actually, I was really surprised. We had about $150, $180 of cash laying in that jar, which were donations and money from the $3 table. Mm. And then there was probably 10 or 15 envelopes that were for people paying for their dues, $10 or more.
There was also a travel bug geocoin table?
Yeah, it was a little different this year. A couple of events I've been at, and it always seems to happen at any event. If people bring travel bugs, they log them in the event, people discover them. And then when the event's over, all the bugs may be gone or there may be some left, and somebody picks them up and takes it. They never get logged out of the event. Whoever runs the event gets emails from the bug owners. I think what worked good this time is L. Frank and his wife, Lori, and they made up a board, and all the travel bugs that were brought were logged in onto a sheet as far as who brought it, and they were hung up on a board where the mission was of the bug to go or whatever was supposed to be done, and then if anybody physically took it somewhere else, then they would log it out on that sheet. So we know at that point who actually has it when it was gone.
So everything's accountable.
And if there's any left, we know who brought it, and we can return it to that person. Mm. Coin table I didn't get involved with, but there's lots of coin books being displayed over there. So I stay away from those things. They looked heavy, I know.
So in general, things went pretty well. How was the weather and the turnout?
Well, the weather was good. Normally we've had cold weather, but today it was supposed to be in the mid-40s and sunny, and I think it was. A lot of people were caching before the event, during, and after. Our 130 were signed up. Looked like we had at least 100 people sign the sign-in sheet, but then some of those included like a family that may have been two or three people with one entry. I think we exceeded our 130 people because we still had about 8 or 10 walk-ins.
How far away did some of the people come?
There was one fellow from Kansas City, and the other one, which I was going to give him a long-distance award, came from eastern end of North Carolina. But they were here, and they signed up, but I never saw them, and then we got ready to give out the awards.
Anything to say about the food?
All very good. I don't think there was any complaints with anybody. In fact, I got the last of the double leg. Okay. That went pretty quick, but I think those always do.
I was the last one in line. Actually, right in front of me was Walt, and he was there for his second. So he let me go ahead of him to get my first, so he'd get his second.
This time we had a very good selection of meat and the main dishes. Normally that seems to be the weak point, is everybody brings dessert or a salad or something. But this time we had more than enough meat and ham and roast beef and chili and escacholi and sandwiches and everything else.
So it seems like we're getting better and better at this thing.
Yeah, people are contributing more to get a little more fair for the rest of the group.
What about the facilities?
I think it's the best we've had. The building is just huge. We could have hit bowling alleys in here, shooting ranges and everything. But
could have hit some caches in there.
Yeah, we could have.
Taken them a while to find them.
Yeah. We had a fireplace, and the park provided the firewood, and Dave, CDS 231, got the fire going. Everybody got here a little bit early. The setup went real good compared to the learning center out there. I think we've outgrown that place. Hopefully we can get this again next year for our next huge event.
Well, thanks again, Rich, for making these things happen.
Okay, no problem.
This concludes the Slaga Podcast. For more information about the Slaga Group and geocaching in the St. Louis, Missouri area, go to www.geostl.com. Here's wishing you a strong signal and a trusty bearing.